And welcome to the Heritage Radio Network as we commence with Burning Down the House, an ongoing conversation about the culture of architecture, in which we tear down, lay forth, and build up again the elements, the attitudes, opinions, fantasies, and the passion for ideas that inform and direct the creation of our built environment. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host and mediator. Joining us are two accomplished and opinionated New York architects. Roderick L. Knox, professor of architecture at the Cooper Union here in New York City. Rod earned a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree and Bachelor of Architecture from the Cooper Union and went on to get his Master's in Architecture from Harvard Design School. He's a veteran of the Navy, a member of the American Institute of Architects, the Royal Institute of British Architects. I got this off your
used
website.
Used to be.
All right. The Architectural League of New York, Architects Council of New York.
Society of New York Architects,
and the New York Coalition of Black Architects.
Used to be.
And he's an avid ping pong player. Nice to have you here. Yeah.
Thank you.
George Y. Suwicki is the designer of the award-winning Ukrainian Museum on East 7th Street in Manhattan, as well as architect of notable projects in the United States and abroad. George earned his Bachelor's of Architecture from the Pratt Institute, is a member of the American Institute of Architects, and is licensed in numerous states throughout the United States. George's practice includes design of retail stores, showrooms, banking projects, office buildings, corporate interiors. He designed and managed the construction of the Kaufman Astoria Film and Television Studios and the St. George Residential Tower Complex. What is even more interesting, I think, is that George, when he's depressed, is an accomplished pianist with a special passion for Chopin. Nice to see you, George.
Good to be here, Curtis.
30 years.
I also play ping pong, by the way. So we have something in common here.
Well, we're going to keep the ball going. Hard topic. 30 years before the birth of a certain well-known Judean carpenter son, the Roman architect Vitruvius wrote, "Hec autem ita fieri debent ut habeatur ratio firmitatis utilitatis venustastis." Of course, I'm sure his pronunciation was much better than mine. Either way, in modern English, he would have us understand that architecture must have an equal portion of three vital characteristics: structural integrity, accommodations for comfort, functionality, and delight, to which I can only say, plus ça change, plus c'est le même, or the more things change, the more they remain the same. For 21 centuries later, we are still debating these three vital elements, especially what I want to talk about tonight, delight. Where has it gone? Have we lost it? What delights us as architects? What do we think delights the paying public? And before we get into our conversation, I think it's time for our first brief break.
Están en spili glindas Gala burtu lendi svona þreytt Vél, einhver hennur ekki hægt að stoppa Hvað á ég að gera Lendi bara í eigum Hitti Johnny
Kemal austan Eins og sólin Með sveikta vél Regina Annars glæsileg
Welcome back. This program is sponsored by TechServe, the number one source for everything related to the Macintosh. Sales, service, repairs on West 23rd Street in Manhattan. Our producer this evening is E.J. Dukoski. Jack Inslee is our engineer. Thank you, gentlemen. And thank you, TechServe. So, Delight, where is it gone? We were talking earlier about the new Tom Maine Morphosis. It sounds like a worm that grew into something.
It's not easy to say.
That's a LA-based architectural firm.
Yes.
And he's just completing a new building for our alma mater, Cooper Union, on Cooper Square. And to me, it looks like a big glass box enclosed in a gigantic enclosure of window screen with a big rip down the front. I don't understand where Delight went in that building. Now, Rod, you know this intimately well.
Well, I describe it as a corpulent woman forcing herself into a dress five sizes too small, and on top of it, she's on crutches. I mean, it's a chronic invalid. I mean, the building is very. I don't know. I mean, why do you have to do all the structural gymnastics? Why do you have to? What is the meaning of it? I mean, it's nothing. It seems to be unnecessary.
Now, the purpose of this building is to provide recreational space for the students at Cooper Union because there is no campus. What else is in the building?
I think they combined the art and engineering school in it, and the architects are, for the most part, will remain in the foundation building.
That's the brownstone building.
Yes.
At the intersection of 3rd Avenue and Bowery, and 4th Avenue. Yes. And so this will be classroom space for artists, for engineers, a new cafeteria.
Yeah, I haven't set foot in.
Yeah, and so to that end, we would have hoped as givers of form, as architects, that this would somehow be understandable to the passerby as being, one, an institution of higher learning, however one might choose to express that, and two, a delightful place for young people to want to go and study. The entrance is open to the street. This dress that's five sizes too small hovers above it. This is the green cladding, very much like the screening cladding of the new museum just down the Bowery a few blocks, which we might want to talk about also. George, you're so quiet.
No, by the way, the architect describes it when a student of mine confronted him with the same argument, and he said, oh, the building is curtsying to the foundation building across the street. That's his...
That's it?
Yeah, it's a curtsy. He sees it as a curtsy. But
It's not a surprising building, though, because I think it actually follows a trend from the last 10, 15 years of buildings being built and designed in order to be sensational, in order to provide some sense of satisfaction to the ego of the architect and the ego of the client. I'm not trying to be disrespectful to the Cooper Union. And the building, if you look at other buildings in the area, you look at the glass box right at Astor Place,
yes,
overlooking Kmart, of
sure,
all places.
Charlie Guathmey's residential building for the related companies.
Yes, yeah, and for people with a lot of money because they were selling these units for like $15 million. And imagine living up there and walking out and you've got Kmart right in front of you. If you go down...
That's an accident of sight, however.
But it was there before the building was built.
Do you think that Charlie Guathmey should have designed a building that somehow embraced the consumerism of Astor Square?
No, I don't think he should have, but I think that somehow the way the building is positioned, the architecture, the vocabulary of the design of the building, and it's not about Kmart, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that, but buildings are totally, totally disrespectful to all of their surroundings, whether it's the Cooper Union building or you go on Bond Street, one of my favorite examples of a building that gives you either diarrhea or indigestion is the the building by Herzog and de Meuer on Bond Street,
yes,
which is the residential building with this wonderful sort of like this mass of vomit along the front of the building.
Now, and hold on, green, now hold on a second.
And this green that has no relationship to anything else on the streetscape of what once was a beautiful streetscape.
Yeah. Now, I have to respectfully disagree because
quite a right.
I love Bond Street. It's so wide, has no traffic. It still right. has its cobblestones.
Has one of the best Italian restaurants in the city right there.
That's an
I'm not plugging them. I don't own it.
That's
I just
definitely
go there.
An architectural attraction. However, I like the Coke bottle green glass because it's brings a little bit of sparkle into an otherwise rather drab masonry facade line on both sides. Although there are some very nice buildings with delightful masonry
absolutely
decorative effects.
Right.
You
right.
work in one of the most decorative buildings in New York City.
Absolutely, yes. I work in the Louis Sullivan building, the Bayard Condit building on Bleecker between Broadway and Lafayette.
And that building has deeply encrusted terracotta panels.
Absolutely.
That have naturalistic
motifs.
Motifs yep. that owe a lot to the Art Nouveau period.
Yes, they do, right. But that building fits in. It fits into the vocabulary of everything that's around it. It's respectful of the other buildings around it. The green vomit building, because that's what I call it, absolutely is just the opposite. It's sort of like Gehry's building, and we touched on it previously, Gehry's building in Prague, on a beautiful, beautiful street of old 19th century classical buildings, and he built this swaying
those are the buildings that are called Fred and Ginger, is that correct?
Yes.
And they
yes.
have a certain provenance in his, or I'm not sure which one came first, his swaying building at MIT.
I'm not sure which one came first either, but it really doesn't matter.
For the interested listener, if you Google on Gehry's recent work, you will see these buildings that are sort of Gumby-like, and they bend and they mm-hmm. twist. They're not like his titanium-clad hermit shell buildings. They're more amorphous, clay-like masses peppered with pierced openings for windows. Would
right.
you say that's about
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
And so we're not finding these delightful because they're not respective of their situation, their site, in situ, their urban context.
Partly, but I think also, if you need to delight in something, you have to feel good about it. You have to feel good about why it was done. You have to understand the reasons behind it. And many of these buildings that we see over the last 15, 20 years are really self-centered and are thinking only about me, 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 me.
But this is not a new thing. When Frank Lloyd Wright consciously,
why did I know that you would bring this up?
decided to break the box mm-hmm. by placing the Guggenheim, yep. which totally breaks the facade line of Fifth Avenue.
Absolutely.
And destroys the scale of both the side streets. He set a precedent of what Robert Venturi would have in his seminal architectural work. Those of you listening, write this down. Complexity and Contradiction in Architecture, where Venturi put forward the notion that there are two kinds of buildings, either decorated sheds, and he used the cathedral at Chartres as his example. and so I suppose to a certain degree, the new building for Cooper might be a decorated shed, although the decoration leaves a lot to be desired if you compare that structure to the Bayard building that Louis Sullivan did on Bleecker Street, or a duck. You know, there used to be this duck building in Long Island. I think it's since been moved to California, but it was a three-story duck. You don't know the duck?
No.
Well, it looked like a duck, and in its belly was a door, and on its wing haunches there were two windows, and it was a... I can't believe you don't know this, George, but this is
I'm
important.
Sorry if I disappoint you.
Well... So the duck was a duck. I mean, it wasn't a decorated shed. It was a duck. It was totally disrespectful, or it just ignored its environment.
This had to be very, very far on the east end of the island.
It was out at, near the Hamptons.
Well, there you go. Okay.
All right. Well,
you need a passport to go out there.
And it was a shrine for architects for so many years that people would go and they would pat the building. They would go in and eventually it became a stand where people went and bought postcards of the duck. And it was so thoroughly self-referential that it was a shrine. It was like going to Lourdes so that you could light a candle in the shape of a foot if you had a crippled leg. It was a place to go simply as a symbolic experience. So Frank Lloyd Wright, well before Venturi set forth the notion of docks or decorated sheds, set the standard for, one, self-promotion. For a century, Frank Lloyd Wright was the most self-promoting architect of all time. And so we have him to thank for these ducks that have been dropped in like some Martian invasion force into the urban fabric. And people delight in the Guggenheim.
Well, I think there is one difference, though. The Guggenheim, no question, would be much better suited to be across Fifth Avenue on the west side in the park.
Which was his original plan, that it would be a pavilion.
So he was right in the first place. But secondly, even where it's located now, it is between two streets. It has a certain identity of itself and a certain separation between that building and the buildings around it. When you look about at the buildings that we're talking about, the Green Vomit Building, the Cooper Union Building, and other buildings, they really don't have that spatial separation that allows them to breathe within the context of the streetscape. There's no contextualism to the other buildings. There is no respect or even recognition of the buildings or the scale of the buildings around them. And that's a big, big difference.
Well, at least Gwathmey's building at Astor Place sits on a podium. The podium attempts to respect the common lot line face if there were adjacent buildings, but because the amoeba sort of, if you look at the floor plan, the amoeboid short glass tower that sits on that podium breaks free of any context or any lot line connections, that one story, which is now full of Chase Bank or something like mm-hmm. that one story podium really does very little to maintain and reinforce the street line. So it's really just a marble sitting at the end of Lafayette Place and the Bowery that lets the space revolve around it. And I can well imagine that Gwathmey thought positively about the revolving notion of space around that tower, just the same way that kids to this day still rotate that awful black cube in the middle of Astor Place.
I actually like that cube. I used to rotate it when I was a teenager.
What say you?
I disagree.
With who?
I disagree
with
both
of us, Curtis.
No, with the I have comments and both things, but I disagree with your assessment of the Gwathmey building. Gwathmey does not. I mean, that was the space that everyone in the world fought over, that space.
True.
And he finally got it. We won't discuss the coincidences that accounted for him getting it, but it was advertised as sculpture for living in. And that really offended me, because architects don't make sculpture. Architects sculptures don't answer to anyone but themselves. They don't have a program. They don't have to deal with firmitas or utilitas. They just, you like it or you don't. And for this man to actually say that he's making sculpture for living in was sacrilege. And, you know, that's a rude building. You can't, it's a freestanding building, but it really isn't. Because the give back space that he's supposed to get, he makes sure that it is not invite in. He makes sure it is rude. You can't walk around that building. He puts a bank and on. I don't know what the developer did, but I mean, maybe he could have. I don't know. I mean, to do that, to just make this glass box and as some sort of parody of the Mesian glass box. I mean, he's on this triangle.
Well, absolutely. It's you know, totally. That Friedrichstrasse project
that
did in 1927,
yeah.
But it's a quarter of the height that it needs to be.
Well, it's not. It doesn't have the you know. There's no big idea there. I like the Guggenheim building. You like it or not? It's a ramp, and it is really utility. What you're looking at. I mean, you're looking at art. I love the Guggenheim Museum. And the reason why I like the Guggenheim Museum is that I take the elevator to the top and I walk down. And it's a great experience.
It is a great experience.
I love looking across that space and seeing everybody else in the museum. And as I walk, I'm looking at people as much as I'm looking at the art.
It's the opera, isn't it?
It is. It's exactly. And maybe it's a happy accident. And but the idea of the, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright was messing around with these ramps before, you know, it didn't just come out of the blue.
Yeah,
he's been doing it, and he led up to this, and it's a good idea. And for what painters didn't like it because you can't look at art you can't hang art on an inclined plane.
Actually, but he,
well,
does,
he proved that you could.
And also, hanging too many pieces of art was anathema to him in the first place. Because remember, he didn't give his residential clients very much wall space. It's the nature of his architecture that it's all free-floating and flowing space with planes like shoji panels. And if you were going to have art, you would have one beautiful piece of art
that he made
ideally. Yes, of course, in a Japanese shrine or tokonoma, and that would be enough. So I think one painting per floor might have suited him fine. I have to tell you, as a little boy, I was always interested in architecture, and I sat up very early one morning when Hugh Downs interviewed Frank Lloyd Wright. The building was almost finished. This is at the very end of Wright's life. And he described how it was indeed his intention, and you'll like this, Rod, that you should take the elevator to the top, just a few people at a time, which is all that's possible because the elevators are so small, and you should promenade down the ramp,
it's
seeing
really
a few pieces.
So nice to just cruise down.
Are we getting a signal from above? I can't read it from here. I'm old.
It's time for a
break. I think it's time for a break.
Just make a break.
We can take a break.
Down the House, continuing conversation about the culture of architecture here on Heritage Radio Network every Thursday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Our sponsor is TechServe, your number one source for all things Macintosh on West 23rd Street in Manhattan. So, gentlemen.
I wanted to add one thing, by the way. It's, you know, the key to this is details. And these, when you take like a Gary building, and it's all about the warp plane. And as an architect, I feel, wow, that's a structural statement. A warp plane is self-supporting.
It should be.
And you expect it to be, you know, structure. But it isn't. It's got steel ribs on the inside. It's all fake. All of this stuff is fake. At least Frank Lloyd Wright tried to make it work. These guys, they don't care. They do a drawing and somebody else somehow puts it together. And the details, at Cooper Union, details mean nothing. They're fudging everything. You can, I mean, architecture is...
I can't disagree with you too much. I've seen the Disney Concert Hall and these huge, beautifully bent pieces of titanium cladding, however, don't fit together in the conch joints. And this is a particular concern to me because my whole practice is on elegant detailing. This is what I help people develop.
That's what architecture
is. But the cock joints are 2 inches high in some places. And then there's the whole problem of it being so highly reflective that it sometimes during the day, the light bouncing off of it blinds people coming into downtown LA.
It cooks them in their apartment.
And they've had to put netting over the structure.
There have been lawsuits.
Yeah.
But I have a story. I want to come back to one of the things that Rod touched on before.
Is this the vomit building again?
No. I will head quite a bit east from there. Gary's building in Bilbao, and Rod touched on the phrase, sculpture. I visited Bilbao a number of years ago, not long after it was built, and unequivocally for me, it is the greatest piece of sculpture, massive sculpture, that I have ever seen in my life. It is absolutely phenomenal. Walking around it, notice I'm using the term around it, on the outside, the experience of sculpture, the experience of forms, and whether they are supported by a framework of metal rib or not, it is still a structural element, is phenomenal. And the forms coming together and the juxtaposition of different types of forms is just superlative.
That's interesting.
But when you walk inside...
Because it is a museum.
It is a museum, exactly. When you walk inside, first thing that they do when you buy your ticket is they give you a little map to guide you through the museum. Because it is so convoluted, it is so unorganized within the inside of this beautiful, beautiful sculptural shape that without a map, there's no way you'll know where you're going. And even people like myself, an architect, who are used to looking at floor plans and understanding floor plans, have a hard time realizing where you are in this building. So halfway through my visit, I needed to visit the men's room. And I'm up on the second level or something, and I'm trying to figure out where the men's room is, and I'm looking at this map in front of me, and I'm turning it one way, the second way, trying to figure out where I am on the map. It took me a couple of minutes to actually realize which way I need to go to get to the men's room. Now imagine normal people who are not architects, of course, how they manage to accomplish this.
Or don't. Did you notice that there were little leaks in the corners or anything like that?
Well, people did go into these little, the little alcoves and sort of stand there for a little while.
So that building falls down on utilitas.
Totally.
Yeah. And affirmitas, too.
Affirmitas, because it's a fraud. It's a statement of structural sculpture.
That's really
Philip Johnson
what it is.
Johnson said that he wept when he first saw the building because it was so beautiful.
He weeps at anything. I mean,
well, not anymore.
Yeah. He's probably still weeping. But the delight in architecture is not a blank slate. It is that tiny little window you have to be creative. And that is where the delight comes from. The delight is taking this program, this utility, this shelter, this thing that offers comfort, and making it beautiful. And that is hard to do. And it's not the same as a delight one. I wouldn't call sculpture delightful. You know, I mean, sculpture is sculpture. Take it or leave it.
Yeah, but you're a painter, so you have a axe to grind.
No. I mean, I don't care for sculpture as much as I do painting. But it all comes down to what I like to say called truth and beauty. And I believe those two terms are the same. And it's hard. I mean, there's no absolute truth. And
there's no absolute beauty.
And there's no absolute beauty. But you have to somehow let your conscience be your guide. You have to strive always to do the right thing. Architecture is an ethical profession. And I am not about to let anyone off the hook. You have to be trusted, and you have to do the right thing, and you have to decide how much you're going to compromise. And it is all these things, when you work with these things, and if you can do something beautiful, then you are divine.
But
heavy.
Earlier, we spoke about Barcelona. You know that when Gaudí began his career, and he did not compromise, and he pursued his own vision of beauty, he was not very popular in the neoclassical or the French Academy circles because his beauty was not their beauty. So how do we know if our contemporary beauty is simply not quite in sync with opinion?
Let me just add, if I may, because I just to tie into what you just said earlier. I went to the Jewish Museum and
in Berlin.
In Berlin.
And Daniel Libeskind.
Yes. And it's sort of like I came out sort of disoriented and seasick, really. And I suppose the whole building is meant to do that to you because it is trying to unsettle you in some way. And it does a great job, but it is it's a piece of sculpture that they've happened to turn into a museum. And the real, it is attached to a traditional building. And it is, people go run into that building and so, wow, you know, and they sit there for a while and get their bearings. Because you have to get out of there. It drives you crazy to be, it's like being in the fun house in a horror house at the carnival. And that this is, I don't know what it is, that these guys like to do things like, you know, this, where you wonder, how is this thing standing up? And they're always trying to do this. Look, repose. Repose is, why be... What's wrong with repose? I mean, it is something that architecture should offer.
The most reposeful and yet, I believe, beautiful building in the world is the Pantheon. Yeah. You cannot walk.
I was going to say the Parthenon.
That too. I mean, it's all that for Treviated stuff and the Pan. You know, funny you should mention that because that is the epitome of the Parthenon is the epitome of the Treviated style and the Archaeated style is a Pantheon, and you can't get any better. That is what brick wants to do. It wants to make arches, and it wants to. That's what it wants to do. That's what concrete and all that stuff. I mean, when you take a building that Sarandon did, the CBS building.
Sure.
I mean, I have a problem with that building because I know that concrete wants to step back. That's the nature of concrete. And to take concrete straight up like steel is upsetting to me. But maybe I'm a stickler.
Or maybe you're upset at the fact that to get into that building, you have to walk
down.
If you can finally figure out how to get in there.
Can walk around the steps until you finally find a door.
Yeah, until you finally find a door.
You're right. Yeah. There's no sign or there's no gesture of here is the entrance.
Yeah.
Stop at a China Grill first.
Well, I don't want to talk much anymore because
if we remember Boston City Hall, which over the years is has increased in the number of people who want it torn down.
And including me.
And me too.
Actually,
because there's no gesture of, here's where you come into the people's house. It's a fortress-like structure. In fact, it gets taller. The taller it gets, the larger it is, so that it's looming over that plaza. And it's really...
You know, it would have been more successful instead of a big concrete plaza outside, if it was a forest, that you had to walk through the forest to get to this monstrosity. You know, but...
Where the Wizard of Oz hung out.
Could even have a little gold brick walk.
Well, that at least would have gotten me to the Gates of Oz.
But the idea of... Turning the pyramid upside down, that the top is accessible to the people, was behind that building. And you say, wow, what a fabulous idea.
But there's no way of knowing where you actually get in, which I think, if you want to get into semiotics or pick your, you know, ism, says everything about Boston politics. Those who are on the inside are in there already. and if you're not getting in. If you're not part of the Cognoscenti,
forget about it.
That's right.
Actually, there are a lot of these buildings now that you have a real hard time figuring out how to get in. Actually, Bilbao is not logical in terms of how you get in. You wouldn't figure that that's the way to get into the building. You look at Gary's windswept building on the West Side Highway on wherever it is. You can't figure out where the entrance is. No way.
Well, and the one next to it. I have problems with that building because of the way that it meets the sidewalk.
Well, sure.
It just sliced off.
Slices it off. You wonder where the rest of the building is
because it wants to be sitting on a three-story podium.
Yeah, but the monstrosity north of it, right adjacent to it, makes Gary's building somewhat... tolerable.
Now, which monstrosity is that, George?
The cube building with all of these cubes going all the way up. Take the West Side Highway. Just drive up there, and there's no way you could miss it.
I'm afraid the scales haven't fallen from my eyes yet. Or perhaps it's so bad I just don't see it.
Well, but you know, you mentioned something before, Curtis, about, you know, how do we know whether these buildings will actually be great pieces of architecture
over time.
Time is the judge. But I would venture to say that if we look at these buildings today and we ask ourselves whether 100 years from now people are going to be really recognizing, or either even if some of these buildings are going to still be standing. The Green Vomit building, I'll bet you dollars to donuts
on Bond Street.
That on Bond Street is not going to be in any architectural book or any architectural lecture put up as an example of good architecture 50 years or 100 years from now.
Well, that's not.
Neither will the Cooper Union question building.
Of whether good architecture is only good because it's in a book, which we'll talk about.
It usually gets in a book because it lasts. Usually.
I think there's plenty of really good architecture that's not notable, that's not famous.
Absolutely. Yes.
That's delightful. It could be a renovation of an entrance to a building that's delightful.
You know, a funny thing happened to me in Berlin. I'm walking along and I went to see the Heydeck. I really went there to see the Heydeck stuff. And I didn't know
he actually ever got anything built.
Yeah, he did two projects there. One in Tegel at the north of Berlin, and this other one at Kreuzberg.
We're talking about John Heydeck, who was the dean at Cooper Union for his entire career, died in 2000.
Yeah, and I'm sort of like walking along after I spent some time there, and it was kind of getting dark, so. And I looked at this building, and I said, that looks like something. I was with some friends, and I said, that looks like something Eisenman would do. And sure enough, it was the Eisenman building.
Eisenman, who was a theoretician and teacher, and who in the beginning of his career as a lecturer actually had a lot of good information to convey until he was overcome by his fame, in my opinion. But his work is interesting because he makes a point of not caring whether it works programmatically. As a matter of fact, he likes to discomfit people, or at least in his early works.
Well,
of course, you know him a lot better than I.
Well, going back to Delight, I mean, Delight for him is intellectual, and I believe that when you, I believe Delight is really visceral. You have to feel it. I mean, you can make the intellect beautiful, but when it's just the intellect alone, it's not sexy.
And that's my problem with so many of these recent buildings, that you need a guidebook. Tom Wolfe wrote about this in his extended essay From Bauhaus to Our House, the parallel trends of art that needed to be explained before you could enjoy it in the late 60s, 70s, and architecture that needed a playbook before you could understand it. And I think if what we do as architects only works on that level, we've failed.
It certainly does.
Absolutely, we've failed.
So,
and yet you see a lot of these types of buildings, a lot of this kind of construction, right and left.
So, gentlemen in the control booth, I think we've come to a place for a natural break. And when we come back, let's talk about what we find delightful.
Okay.
Burning down the house here in the Heritage Radio Network, sponsored by TechServe, number one spot for everything related to the Mac. I just want to interject a guest, Ann Saxelby, who's part of the other part of this radio network and a cheesemonger par excellence, and she's going to explain to us the provenance of Venturi's duck.
Yes, so I was just saying to Curtis that it seems oddly appropriate that would come up on the Heritage Radio Network, because that duck building was actually constructed because Long Island, up until very recently, was the largest producer of ducks, meat ducks, anywhere in the country. So that duck was kind of the beacon for all the duck farms around there. And
now we have food for thought.
And now we have food for thought, exactly.
Thank you, Ann.
Why a duck?
Why not? You were saying, delight. What delights us? What delights you, George?
In architecture or other matters?
Let's leave it to architecture.
Well, everything is architecture. So,
architecture
really
touches on everything, every place that we work, live, love.
I think what delights me in architecture, in buildings, and I will stay with that, is a building that has integrity, where you can understand the reason, you can understand the form, you can understand the thought that goes into it, you understand the respect that it has for itself, for its function, for its neighbors. A building that has an intrinsic style, an elegance to it, and a beauty that you recognize just from looking at it.
No offense, but it just sounds like the Scout Oath.
Goodness gracious!
You know, Scout is trustworthy.
Well, then
loyal,
you know what? Friendly. Let me put it another way, Curtis.
I mean, this sounds abstruse. You know, if you walk down the street and you see a building, what would really grab you?
I'll tell you what wouldn't grab me. Maybe that's a better way of describing it.
All right.
What wouldn't grab me is a building that clearly was built in order to be sensational, was built to make an impact, was built based on whether it is the clients or the architects.
Impact could be good.
It depends. If not, if that's the only reason the design was developed.
Basilica makes impact.
Yes, but it also strove to the heavens to reach God. It also used incredible new structural concepts in order to build that incredible dome. And it's urbanistically integrated. Exactly.
Right.
What I'm saying is, if the building is built only for the purpose of impact, leaving aside everything
else, or sensation,
or sensationalism, right? Then that is the kind of building that will not create joy, will not create a sense of beauty, will not create the delight that you're looking for.
But let me ask you, as an architect, if a client comes to you and say, I want a building and I want an impact, I want this building to say, hey, you know, I mean, would you turn that down and say, I wouldn't do that? I mean, that's a program.
That's true.
Yeah, and
you would not turn it down. But what you would do is you would try to guide it in a direction that addresses his needs, his aspirations, his dreams, or her dreams, aspirations.
No, the problem is that when you make it an impact else. And the program, and it's inappropriate to the program, because they're buildings that really should be quiet. The program is a quiet program, but they're loud because of that. For the sake of being loud.
Right. You know, there are buildings, I think, that make impact, and I'll give you an example. This has been around for a long time, and it's overshadowed by other buildings because it's on a side street, is the Ford Foundation building, which was built probably, I would guess, maybe 40 years ago. It's on West, I forget, 40
years. Well, a building that is so sublime, it's almost invisible.
Well, that's what I'm saying. But if you look at that building, and you look at what that building actually created, and the environment for the use of the building within it, and yet the elegance and the beauty of the entire building.
For those of you who haven't ventured over there, it's a dark building. It's dark brown, but yet it has an atrium that's been filled with a tropical rainforest.
Yes.
My problem with that building is that the passerby is not invited into the tropical rainforest.
And now with 9/11, nobody goes in there. 9/11 has ruined it where you can't even walk in buildings anymore.
Yeah.
But what gives me delight, I want to say, is the old skyscrapers of Lower Manhattan. Most of which
are in the Art Deco style.
The Industrial Revolution, spawned all these steel frame buildings, and the difference with New York steel frame buildings and Chicago's steel frame buildings is that steel frame the Chicago ones were big fat boxes.
That celebrated the frame with the curtain wall.
Yeah, and they want to grab as much space as possible. In New York, it's a tall, thin tower. They were confined to this little space, and they also had this harbor that they want to. That's how people came by ship, and that's what you saw.
And so each building wanted to be like its own tall mast,
yes,
to be visible.
Yes.
As you're steaming in.
And here is a steel frame that has on it. On these old skyscrapers, what makes them different?
But don't you think? Let's go back to Gary, though. Isn't that dishonest that you hide the steel frame?
No, right. That's what I'm getting to. Is that they hang, like a Renaissance palazzo on in stone on this steel frame, which is improbable. But it's a beautiful lie, and a lie is okay if it's beautiful.
Honey, I love you so much.
I would take exception with that.
No,
a lie is still a lie.
I just have to take this call from my mistress.
No, they talk about the brutal truth and a beautiful lie. And quite frankly, because there are no absolute either one that we talked about earlier, when you look at these buildings and you say, my God, I take my students and I say, look at that building. Lintels are doing what they're supposed to do. I mean, it's a skin. It's fake.
A lintel is the member over the top of a window opening.
Window sills, everything, all the articulation on the building is obeying the vocabulary of architecture. Architecture is a formal condition. And these things, you know, you look at it and you say, oh my God, look at that. And it's true. It's truth. It's truth in stone. But it's hanging there. But there's something interesting that I find interesting.
So
that
you find delight in the totality of expression.
Yes.
Because at one point, the French Academy, the École des Beaux-Arts, wanted to take the decorative arts and put them over here and call them architects and take Firmitas and Comeditas, put them over there and call them engineers. And then there was a lot of conversation about that in the 1860s and 70s until Viollet-le-Duc, and we remember him, the decadence of style. We'll do that in a different program.
Next segment.
Yes. Said, no, they must all be together. You cannot take decorative effect away from structure, because then you have kick decorating over here and you have builders and true architects on the other side. But that takes away from the true builders. So what you're saying, what is really fabulous about New York is because it is rich in expression.
Yes, and also my final point is that going all the way back from the very beginning, when you look at the Greek temple and you see vestiges of wood construction on the stone, and so, and you say, my God, you look at the Colosseum, and you see the Greek orders on an archaeated structure, and you say, wow, what's going on here? And then you move up and you see the Romanesque and the Gothic all do that. They take the precedent style, the vanquished style, and render it as a chronic invalid and hang it as pure decoration on their facade. A new order is in place, and they are no longer effective. And so that's what was going on with the New York. I like to read it that way anyway. That it is that this is for a new style to be born, you have to take the old style and say, ha, you're retired. There you are, your decoration. You're hanging on my facade as an invalid.
I've always wanted to do that. Do a pure glass box and hang 19th century ornaments on it.
You're right.
And say, isn't this pretty?
Yes, exactly. You know, delight. It's delightful.
Yeah, well,
Stanford, you see that in certain museums. You see really beautiful new boxes, and then you will see old masters being hung there in a very pristine way, and it is quite delightful.
Sure,
absolutely.
Let the
absolutely.
Old be
the juxtaposition
old, the
between
so
one and the other is terrific.
Tom Main's building. What's wrong? He doesn't even have a fragment of the foundation building embedded in his skirtings.
I mean, look, I really do like the building is.
We don't have to belabor it. Let's talk about a different building. We've probably trashed that enough.
No, well,
let's go back to George. George,
we trashed a couple of buildings.
No. I mean, you look at the foundation building, and you can see the skylights tell you it's an art school.
And you see the structure. It's a cast iron building. You can see that it's.
And you can look right through the library there on the first floor, and
it's totally transparent.
And this building, nobody knows what it is. Nobody knows what it is.
It's sort of Cooper's own secret society from Yale, without the. Skull and crossbones connotation.
They all know I don't.
Let me tell you what delights me in architecture. There's I'm a sucker. I'll go for the simple things. The interplay of light on form does wonderful things for me, which is why I'm a fan of loggias that bring the outside in and the inside not quite to the
any particular
face.
One that comes to mind.
Well, there's Italian models. Some of the more late 20th century buildings. The building that's across from MoMA, for example, has a plaza as you're facing out from 53rd Street towards this. I think it's Ellerby Beckett or someone like that. And it's sort of cruciform in plan, and it's very ornate in that 80s kind of style with overwrought marble. And if you look beyond that, and there's a loggia there. and there's a through street connection, and that brings people through to the MoMA entrance, and it makes the possibility of maybe even opening up a piazza in 53rd Street and close it off and making a public space. Now, the new MoMA itself engages the street like a shipping container that's just been parked there. You go through the revolving door, and then you're in a maze where you don't really know where to go, just like in Bilbao. So I think they really... I wish to say I look forward to the next renovation of MoMA, when they restore a sense of place.
Well, I think they've maxed out.
There's not much space left.
There's nothing left.
Well, they can just...
Which actually comes back to the comment that Rod had before about the difference between the buildings in Chicago and New York. And let's not lose sight of one thing, that the forms of these buildings in Chicago, you did have these massive, big stone edifices, whereas in New York, they went vertical, is a question of zoning. And the zoning ordinances in different...
Right.
Urban centers, and specifically if you compare New York City to Chicago, will dictate and absolutely do dictate the basic form, shape, and the extent of how buildings are constructed, because it limits the size of streets, blocks, and what you can do and where you need to sit.
And yet, in New York, we get around it by buying air rights so that you end up with very tall buildings in very low-rise areas. I'd like to have you both back sometime. I'd like to talk about commissions we would not take and why our colleagues should not take them. Case in point, the new St. Vincent's building on 13th Street that's going to tower over its neighbors, which I find atrocious and an act of civic desecration.
And blasphemy. I'm sure that
I know.
Although I will say, in this economy right now, I think there'll be very few architects out there who are willing to not take a commission.
Howard Roark went and broke rock rather than prostrate himself to the almighty dollar. I mean, we have to remember the fountainhead.
Yes, but I prefer it Atlas Shrugged.
I think we've come to the end. Jack, give us the music. Been burning down the house on the Heritage Radio Network. TechServe, the number one Mac source, has been our sponsor. EJ Dukoski has been our producer. Jack Inslee is our engineer, and I am Curtis B. Wayne, architect, writer, and your host for Professor Roderick L. Knox and George Y. Sawicki, architects par excellence. Thank you, gentlemen, so much, and we'll see you next Thursday when we talk about feng shui.